KALW. The glint of gold is pretty cool because, you know, especially when the sun's shining, it's like there's nothing like that.
The California gold rush petered out in the mid-1800s, but it never quite ended.
Oh, if I get $500 worth, a quarter of an ounce, I'll be happy. If I do less than that, I'm still happy. I'm happy just to be out here.
Today, we meet modern-day gold miners in a story from our series At Work. Then, ballet dancer Roberto Vega Ortiz creates a space for male and non-binary artists to perform en pointe.
There is a place they can call home if they decide to dance on point. It's accepted, and it's not only accepted, but celebrated.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Right now, during the summer, when the rivers of the Sierra foothills are low, you may see folks standing on the banks, popping up from behind rocks with shovels and buckets. Turns out they're looking for gold in what was once gold country. KALW's Catherine Monahan stashed her microphone in her water bottle, hopped in an inner tube, and caught up with a few of these modern-day gold miners midstream in this edition of KALW's original series, At Work.
There's gold all over in this river. Different spots have different quantities.
Randy Hedgie has been mining for gold for 25 years. This morning, he's on the Bear River between Auburn and Grass Valley. It's pretty gentle as California rivers go, mostly shallow. There are pine, oak trees, little clouds of butterflies.
Sierra, look at the ducks over there.
I follow Randy and his sweet black dog Sierra across the rapids. Randy's using his shovel as a walking stick. The rocks are slippery and mossy, and he's no spring chicken. He tells me most of his right arm is titanium inside after an old fall from El Capitan. He starts digging in the riverbed.
Do you see when I'm digging this dirt right here? Do you see the color of the mud? There's a saying, the redder the better. That ain't red. See if there's any red down there.
He puts a screen on top of his bucket and starts shoveling rocks through it.
All I'm doing is agitating the dirt to break away any gold that's in it. And then I'll check the screen, and I'll just see if there's any big gold pieces. The Bear River doesn't produce a lot of big gold pieces.
Well, not anymore. Gold was first discovered in California just about 20 miles from here in 1848. Miners streamed in from all over the world. They quickly exhausted the surface gold using tools like Randy's, so they tunneled into the mountains and blasted the riverbanks with water cannons. By the 1860s, there wasn't much gold left. I think most of us figured that was the end of the story. I did. But it turns out, in the late 1970s, the price of gold shot up when the U.S. took the dollar off the gold standard, and people like Randy went out looking for whatever was left. They used dredges, which are basically underwater vacuums.
When we were dredging here 20 years ago, we had days that we had 2 and 3 ounces in a day. Now, it would be $5,000.
But Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger ended that in 2009.
Yeah, Arnold wasn't too hip on things. He made it a law that we couldn't dredge anymore. Said it destroyed the river habitat for the trout. Well, yeah, I don't think it hurts them at all. My personal opinion.
Nowadays, people have to get at the gold by hand. It's backbreaking work, and the profit on a given day is unpredictable.
Oh, if I get $500 worth, a quarter of an ounce, I'll be happy. If I do less than that, I'm still happy. I'm happy just to be out here.
Randy makes his living mining and metal detecting.
Heck, I got almost $1,000 last week in gold rings.
That sounds like a lot of money. So I ask some other miners. Scott Kuhn is in a full wetsuit, and it's 106 degrees today. He says it's worth it.
Yeah, I made like $45 an hour the other day.
Yeah. That ain't too bad.
No, it's better than going and sweating on a job site somewhere.
Micah Kiewat was in the Army for 26 years. He hasn't found much gold today. He doesn't think $45 an hour is common, based on the price of gold.
It breaks down to roughly $66 per gram, which is not much bigger than the fingernail on your pinky finger, a little bit thicker. So if you meet someone that says that they're making about that much per hour, that means that they're on a good spot where they're finding at least 1 gram of gold collectively per hour. Or he's telling a fish story.
Finding a good spot can make all the difference, which is probably why most of the miners I talk to are pretty cagey about where to look. But Micah breaks it down. He says gold erodes from quartz veins in the mountains, and winter rains carry it down the rivers. Since it's 19 times heavier than water, it sinks where the current slows down, like on the inside of sandbars or when the water hits a boulder.
When the water comes together on the backside of the boulder and it swirls a lot, that creates a low pressure zone. And on the downstream side of a big boulder, you might find a trail of a little gold powder right behind that boulder.
Micah says the drought is both good and bad for mining. A lower water level makes it easier to access the gold, but without winter rains carrying it down the hillsides, there's less of it. Talking to the miners, it becomes clear that this is not just about the money. For Micah, it's also the connections.
Sometimes you run into people that are just really weird people to you, or just uncommon, you know, to what you're used to as far as the lifestyle or the way their mannerisms operate. And you can use something like this to just come together as people.
For others, there's something like gold fever.
It's millions of years old. Why wouldn't you want to find a rock that's millions of years old, that's malleable and it's the most useful metal in the world so far?
The glint of gold is pretty cool because, you know, especially when the sun's shining, it's like there's nothing like that.
But they all seem to agree, and this is what surprises me, that the biggest reason they're out here on the river is because the river is beautiful.
I see miracles every day, little things that just put a smile on your face.
Randy gets nostalgic.
One day, I was right in this area, and I was sitting there drinking a beer, and right upstream, there was two deer crossing, and I had a fishing pole in one hand, and I had a sluice out here. I don't get any better than that. I could pee in my pants if I wanted to.
The sun is fully up in the canyon now, and it's hot, although the water's nice and cold. Randy is pouring his bucket of dirt into the sluice, kind of a metal slide that sorts flakes of gold from the rocks.
See if there's any of that gold stuff in here. There's a piece of gold right there. You see it right down there?
Yeah. Randy says he'll never stop looking for gold.
I think we're all out here subconsciously wanting to get rich today. Always, very seldom happens. You never know. You never know.
On the Bear River, I'm Catherine Monahan for Cross Currents.
That story first aired in 2021. You can find it along with all our stories of people at work at KELW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Empointe is a technique where ballet dancers support their body weight on their toes while their feet are in a vertical stance. Traditionally, it's been performed by female dancers, but Roberto Vega Ortiz challenges these gender roles. Roberto is one of the co-founders of the dance company Ballet 22. What started off as a fun online project during the pandemic turned into a space in Oakland for men and non-binary artists to feel comfortable and perform empointe professionally. They perform classical to contemporary ballet with the values of inclusivity of all body types and genders, and they amplify queer voices. KLW's Janae Darden spoke with Roberto.
You grew up in Puerto Rico, which has such a rich and beautiful culture.
Yes.
Why ballet? What drew you to ballet?
I guess it was kind of ballet shows me in a way, as cliche as that sounds. I've always danced my entire life. you know, in school, just like any events. I used to be a cheerleader, actually. That's kind of how I started the actual like dancing and talent shows. And it wasn't until I was in eighth grade, yeah, that I had a, there was a small studio in my town. And she was like, you have to. I was working with her in a piece we were doing for our pep rally. And she was like, you have to come to the dance studio. And I was like, you know, sure. And my parents were like, well, we can't pay for it, all these things. She was like, don't worry about it. You know, it's just come. And I started dancing jazz and hip hop. And I was like, yes, living my life. And I was like, so happy. And then one day she made me take ballet. And I was like, uh-oh, no. It's like, that's it. That's the line for me. I'm not taking ballet. And she was like, you have to go in. Go. And I didn't have any ballet attire or anything. I just had sweatpants and socks. I did my first position. Mm-hmm. And that was it. It felt correct. It felt like it was meant to be.
Did dancing more traditional feminine moves in Puerto Rico and then coming to the mainland and being more around men, dancing ballet, did that maybe influence you or start you thinking about challenging traditional gender roles in ballet?
I mean, yes, absolutely. And I think the way that I trained or what I saw in growing up, and, you know, I would even do the point classes, but not on point, just on flat. And all those things really, it was, for me, it was always, you know, female, it was always punches. It was like this idea. So being around that, I think really developed what, you know, what I like today, you know, and what I think it's fun for myself to dance. And I just kind of never connected as much with that other part. That was really what was expected of myself as a dancer. And it was really hard. It was really hard mentally trying to kind of ignore that other side and focus on something that was, it really didn't call my name in a way. It was just like, okay, you have to do it just because this is, again, what's expected.
So how did Ballet 22 come to be?
During the pandemic, the height of the pandemic, my really, you know, best friend and, you know, he's like my everything, Carlos Hopuy, he is also a dancer from Cuba. And we danced together at Ballet Trocadero in New York City. And we love teaching. We love what we do. He's been a mentor of mine since I met him. You know, he's just so experienced and the best of the best. And during the pandemic, we started this platform called Male Ballerinas. And we just started offering classes, just like a lot of people did, on Zoom. And it was kind of amazing how we kind of gathered this global community, literally from everywhere, from Germany to Japan, South America, Europe. It was like incredible, really. And we just kept teaching. Then I went to the Central Coast with Theresa, and then we became roommates real quick. And that was kind of like the birth. We asked a few dancers if they would be interested in recording themselves. And I was like, be in your living room, be outside, be wherever you can, but be on point. And we made this video. It was pretty great. And Theresa was like, I don't think this should just be a video. Like, this shouldn't just be an Instagram post. Like, we need to do something larger than this. And I was like, yeah, sure. Like, Carlos and I have talked about creating a company for years. You know, it's kind of like a dream, but unattainable in a way, right? We're just dancers. None of us went to college. We don't know anything. And Therese actually has a business administration degree. And she was like, let's do it. I have a little bit of savings. Like, let's make it happen. I was like, you're crazy. Sure, let's go. You know, and I was like, okay, if you say so. And right there, she got the spreadsheets out. She told me everything about spreadsheet. She thankfully had another project that she had already had fiscally sponsored. So there was kind of a template that she had already worked on by herself. And she was like, on the computer. And I was like, oh my God. And that was it.
What has been some of the reactions that have surprised or moved you the most from audience members?
I think it's their representation, absolutely. Not only from male dancers, from females, a lot of them, you know, or a lot of non-binary transgender folks that have been in the audience, and they were like, oh my God, I quit ballet because it didn't represent me. I didn't fit in. I wanted to do this and I wasn't allowed, or that, or I was too tall. A lot of females that were like, they told me I was too tall to dance on point, and I'm just seeing this person who is 6'4" dancing on point and living their best life. How come I was told that I could not do it as a 5'9", 5'11", 6 feet tall woman? And, you know, or even goes down to kids, and they're like, I want to dance on point. And the mother is like, oh, honey, I'm sorry. Like, men don't really do that. And then all of a sudden they're in our show and they're like, oh my God. And not only that, they see that there is a place they can call home if they decide to dance on point, but how the audience receives it, in that it's accepted, and it's not only accepted, but celebrated.
As you know, there's been more efforts in this country to suppress the LGBTQ plus community. What is, you know, launching Ballet 22 at this time mean to you and to the movement for LGBTQ plus rights?
Yeah. You know, I think it's the same with, you know, Black Lives Matter and like all these things that people are fed up. It's enough. And of course the pandemic really did kind of like made that spin and like turn, and they're like, this is not acceptable anymore. We can't continue this. And especially in the ballet field, how, you know, either like flesh tone tights and flesh tone point shoes and all these things, and we queer, and like now there are dancers who are non-binary dancers who are actually able to kind of step in those traditional female roles, and how we've you know, it's made people, it's not okay for society anymore. So people, you know, they're being pressured to change and adjust and move on with our today's society that it's not 400 years ago. It's not the same. We've moved on, we've changed. Yes, ballet is very traditional. There is something that makes ballet unique, and it makes it ballet. And those things should not change. Now, all the horrible things that come with that, that it's like, you don't have to be mean to get something across, or like, so many things that are really, really, really wrong with ballet. That doesn't need to happen anymore. And if it's not today, if it's not now, then when?
That was ballet dancer Roberto Vega Ortiz speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. That interview was produced with help from Porfirio Rangel. Roberto will be performing with his dance company Ballet 22 on July 29th and 30th at the Cowell Center in San Francisco. You can find that information and more at KLW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next, in an episode from our literary podcast, New Arrivals, we hear a reading from an author's memoir reflecting on her father.
This is New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Eric Newton lives in Mill Valley. He's reading from the memoir Circle Way, written by his late wife, Mary Ann Hogan. The book came out February 15th, 2022.
Circle Way is a daughter's quest to understand her father. In Marianne's case, it's Bill Hogan, the longtime literary editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. And the quest leads back through time and to the conclusion that there are only two kinds of folks: the people who can escape the prisons of their own making and the people who can't. Here's just a little bit of it. In so many ways, I am my father's daughter. Self-made journalists, we. Introverts, lovers of books and wine, sufferers of flying thoughts. We once held prized newspaper jobs, writing for the masses, but we felt like imposters with nothing to say. At times, I still do. My father, I believe, was emotionally crippled by the long reach of his once-famed, anti-intellectual Catholic California family. A family devastated by the loss of fortune in the crash of 29. A family that fell to pieces under the tyranny of its own prosperity. Has this rolled down to me? Can I do this book? To what degree does family mean destiny?
That was Eric Newton reading from Circle Way, written by his late wife, Marianne Hogan.
New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse. You can hear more at klw.org/newarrivals. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. An endangered Chinook salmon species is getting some much-needed help.
When I see gravel like this and how clean it is, it really makes me excited and happy.
A sneak peek from the upcoming season of KLW's The Spiritual Edge, tomorrow at 5. Before we leave you, here's some new music from a Bay Area artist.
A long time ago, when I was still a girl, I gave birth to you and you changed my world. How I loved you so. I kissed you from head to toe. I'm still your mother, you know.
This is Nick Lawrence from Santa Rosa, and this song is from his new album, I Am a Man.
And bouncy blonde hair, your eyes filled with laughter, never a care how you giggled so. I rocked you to and fro. I'm still your mother, you know. Life has a way of changing course. The light from within is a mighty strong force. I took a turn to follow my heart, but I never thought.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Monica Gomez, Hanisha Herjani, Gabe Graben, James Rollins, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Shaya Levitt, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.